Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, June 15th, and this is episode 15 of The Rift. If you've paid any attention to the news since Donald Trump took office for his second term as President of the United States, it's probably been pretty hard to miss what his administration has been doing to the federal government. From day one, the administration began issuing an avalanche of executive orders and administrative actions to slash and freeze federal funding for all manner of agencies and programs. These attacks have been wide-ranging, from slashing research funding for the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, to attempting to dismantle the Department of Education, to cutting funding for many federal programs related to racial and gender diversity. The Republican Party's budget proposal for the coming year attempts even deeper cuts and regulatory rollbacks to federal agencies. Many of the administration's actions have been at least temporarily held up by legal challenges in court, which isn't a shock, being that many of them are flagrantly illegal. However, the Trump administration has still managed to do a considerable amount of damage, and the resulting uncertainty in government agencies and programs has had a swift chilling effect on their operations. Not to mention that whether or not some of these legal challenges are successful, their necessity has further exposed the instability of the U.S.'s governing institutions. Of course, much of this is also a result of the brief but destructive tenure of Elon Musk, the man once known primarily as the CEO of Tesla Motors, but now known primarily for sharing white supremacist conspiracy theories on the website formerly known as Twitter, and allegedly using copious amounts of ketamine while heading up the newly formed Department of Government Efficiency. Although Musk's days of direct involvement in the federal government are now over thanks to a falling out with Trump and others in the administration that was about as predictable as it was stupid, it was DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, that helped instigate the mass firings at federal agencies, which have left many of them performing at vastly reduced capacity, if they're performing at all. It comes as no surprise that, owing to the Republican Party's longstanding program of climate denialism and support for companies that engage in industrial pollution, climate action and environmental protection have been major targets of the Trump administration's attacks. Trump has got funding for various clean energy programs under the Inflation Reduction Act, withdrawn the United States from the Paris Climate Accords, and rolled back clean air and water regulations. The EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, in particular, has been heavily affected both by mass firings and regulatory rollbacks. Under the new leadership of climate denier Lee Zeldin, the agency has fired hundreds of workers while moving to repeal emissions regulations on power plants, wastewater, and air pollution, and eliminate the agency's environmental justice programs. It may be the biggest step backward in the agency's history and has left many wondering what the future of environmental regulation in the United States might look like. That was one of the questions I took to Ellie Hagen, a former EPA scientist based in Chicago. Ellie worked for the EPA for years before leaving recently in the wake of the Trump administration's attacks on the agency. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about how the cuts affected her work and others, how government workers are trying to fight back, and what it might take to rebuild a better version of the EPA. But first, programming at WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop is located at 601 East Main Street in Mahomet. 217-855-9673 and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop. And now, here's my conversation with former EPA scientist Ellie Hagen. I'm joined now by Ellie Hagen, former scientist in the Environmental Justice Program at the EPA. Ellie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So just to start out, when you were working at the EPA, what did you do? What kinds of programs and issues did you work on?
Yeah. So I started working at EPA under the first Trump administration. I was there for about 5 years. My first job at the EPA was working on water quality issues, a lot of the times with tribal nations. So while I was doing that work, I noticed a huge disparity in the environmental conditions at many reservations versus neighboring cities. I noticed a lack of federal resources that were going to tribes, although they're sovereign nations, and there was often a huge disparity in the amount of resources that states received versus what tribal nations received. And there also seemed to be a lack of autonomy in implementing their environmental programs versus states, even though, again, tribes are sovereign nations. So witnessing the kind of disparity that we were seeing with tribal nations, it kind of got me interested in working on the environmental justice program, which was ramping up in about 2022 under the Biden administration. So for the past 2 years, I spent time in the environmental justice program. And there were really kind of two arms to that program. One was kind of the direct community work, and the other was the grant administration. So I guess just to back up for a second, environmental justice is the concept that the EPA has put forth as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, and national origin, with respect to developing and implementing environmental laws and regulations. So we know based on the data that not everyone has equal access to a clean and healthy environment. So the community work that we were able to do kind of recognized that the law isn't enough to protect people. So we were able to do voluntary work to prevent harmful environmental exposure and build capacity in communities, like doing direct community engagement on things like lead poisoning prevention or childhood asthma. And then also the grants that we had were a huge investment that we were able to provide to communities to do things like removing lead service lines, improving wastewater infrastructure, and improving community resilience to the impacts of climate change.
Got it. So, you know, frankly, a lot of that stuff sounds like material that the Trump administration has been explicitly targeting as far as these cuts go, things like environmental justice, you know, focus on racial disparities. So how did the cuts affect your work specifically?
Yeah. So working in the federal government for so long, when the one thing that when Trump won kind of kept us calm that maybe some of the work could continue is that bureaucracy typically takes a long time to work. So we knew that Trump didn't agree with a lot of the principles of the environmental justice program, but environmental justice has been a thing at EPA since 1992, since President George H.W. Bush created the Office of Environmental Equity. So we kind of had hope that maybe we would be able to continue this work, maybe under a different name. But on January 20th, the day of the inauguration, an executive order was signed. Environmental justice was kind of lumped in with DEIA, and there was a federal ban on DEIA and environmental justice work. So we really saw all of our work grind to a halt pretty immediately, which honestly for a lot of people who work in the government is pretty shocking that change happens that quickly. So immediately I was not able to respond to any external emails. I had people contacting me about issues, In their community, I was not allowed to respond. We saw the cancellation of nearly all of those grants that I mentioned. Then finally, it kind of culminated in on the eve of Earth Day, everyone in my program received a notice of termination.
Wow. Yeah. And I want to ask a little bit more about how suddenly all of this happened. Like you said, I think that a lot of people don't necessarily expect executive power to be able to do some of this stuff. And of course, I know that some of these actions were not legal, right? They were disputed in courts. And how did all that kind of land with everyone working at the EPA?
I think it was really shocking. Just as you mentioned, there are checks and balances in place to ensure that the executive branch doesn't have all-consuming power, right? Congress is supposed to approve new reorganizations that occur within the federal workforce. For example, closing entire offices typically happens with congressional approval. But like you mentioned, we saw an executive order that attempted to do just that. And then with the cancellation of all the grants, I mean, this was millions and billions of dollars of grants that were promised to communities and to local government to do vital environmental cleanups. Work had already started. People were expected to get paid. And we saw all of those be terminated pretty immediately. I think the legality of that is still being challenged. But what I noticed was statements that were being made by the administration that did not match up with what I was witnessing. So, for example, when the environmental justice grants were terminated, I believe the EPA came out and said that they did an independent review of all of those grants. And by the way, it was 400 plus grants. They did an independent review of all of these grants to determine that they no longer aligned with the administrator's priorities. But that's not what I witnessed being internal to EPA. I witnessed these grants essentially being terminated in batches based on the terms and conditions of the grant. So essentially being terminated based on how easy it was, based on the terms of the contract to terminate them, if that makes sense. So not an independent review of the project, which a lot of these were not partisan. None of them were partisan. It was removing lead service lines. It was helping communities who face environmental disparities. So they're words weren't aligning with their actions. And I think to get back to your question, the reason this was able to happen so fast is because I believe checks and balances are being completely ignored.
Right. And even as some of these actions are being challenged in the courts, the practical effect of them right now is that the agency is being totally destabilized. And, you know, as you said, you were given notice a couple of months ago, but my understanding is that things got bad enough at the agency that you resigned before your scheduled final day. And so I'm wondering how you saw the impacts of these actions kind of manifest around you.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing a complete and total shift in the agency's mission. So the EPA, their stated mission is to protect human health and the environment. And we've been doing that since, the 1970s. But pretty quickly, EPA's new administrator, Lee Zeldin, came out with five pillars. And I want to talk about three of those, if that's okay. So I'll just list them. Restore American energy dominance. Make the United States the artificial intelligence capital of the world. And then protect and bring back American auto jobs. So these are three of the five pillars that are supposed to be how EPA moves forward in this new administration. EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment by regulating pollutants that enter the environment. Our job is, as I understand it, is not to protect and bring back a certain sector's jobs or to make the U.S. the artificial intelligence capital of the world. So I think one of the shocking things that I saw was a just complete and utter shift in our mission. Things that don't align with me and don't align with, I would say, a lot of the people who took jobs to protect human health and the environment. Administrator Zeldin also proudly announced the greatest day of deregulation our nation has ever seen. So EPA does plan to repeal over 30 rules He was also quoted by saying that this would drive a dagger straight into the heart of the climate change religion. So one of those rules that they're seeking to overturn is the 2009 endangerment finding, which determined that there are greenhouse gases, six of them, that endanger public health. And then it allows EPA to regulate those greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide. And this ensures that we're protecting people against, and fighting back against the impacts of climate change, which we know is a huge human health and even national security issue. But that's just one of the rules that the Trump administration is seeking to overturn, again, twisting the mission of the agency. And then on top of that, on top of the shifting of the agency's mission, there's also this like purposeful tactic to inflict trauma on federal workers. Russell Vought, who was a main architect of Project 2025 and who is now a high-ranking government official. He's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, so has a lot of power over what the government is able to do. He stated that he wants to inflict trauma on federal bureaucrats, and I think this is one step in their mission to drive people out of the agency so that they can be... so that there's less regulation and that there's less standing in their way of complete executive autonomy.
Right. So, you know, on that subject, as a worker at the EPA, you were a member of the American Federation of Government Employees, which is the labor union that represents most federal employees. And obviously, I would imagine that when labor union leadership hears a direct declaration of war, more or less, against their members, they're going to have something to say about it. I'm curious what the response of both the union leadership and, you know, the rank and file membership has been to the assault that the administration has kind of waged on these agencies.
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel so lucky to have been a part of a union, especially a strong federal union. And proudly, I still am a member, even though I don't work for EPA anymore and I'm still active in the union. But yeah, the union has done a lot of things. So there's been a number of lawsuits, I think dozens of lawsuits. But the ones that I think would be important to highlight is opposing the executive order that would ban our collective bargaining rights, opposing the mass termination of probationary employees. So probationary employees, I think back in February, were terminated on a mass basis. I know it made the news, but this was really detrimental because this was supposed to be the next generation of scientists that were going to take on the work of the EPA. I think right now, at the end of the Biden administration, about 30% of the EPA was eligible to retire. So there was a little bit of a misconception. Probationary employees were not people who were on probation due to poor performance. They were people who were within their first 1 to 2 years of employment at the federal government, who weren't as protected by unions and were able to be fired en masse. So they've released, they've litigated against that mass firing of probationary employees. They've also been really great at pushing back against the DOGE data security breaches. So I think there are a number of lawsuits to gain access to DOGE emails to understand exactly what DOGE is doing and push back on the data breaches that DOGE was committing. And then also pushing back on Schedule F, which would change the classification of employees to be at will and allow them to be removed a lot more easily from federal service.
Yeah, that's all really important work. And I'm sort of curious, though, you know, some of this stuff seems like it would directly contravene things like the National Labor Relations Act. And my understanding is that some of that is because, you know, public sector unions aren't necessarily so subject to that, right? They are subject to a totally separate legal framework called the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And I'm curious about whether the union has been restricted in any way in the scope of what they're able to do in response to these attacks.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not a lawyer, so I can only speak kind of broadly about this, but I think this is one area to highlight, like the Trump administration's hypocrisy, right? They claim to be pro-worker and they claim to care about the American worker, yet they're attacking the union on multiple fronts. So, yeah, it's my understanding that the FLRA, as well as the Merit System Protection Board, the MSPB, both need quorum. So they both need three members who are appointed by the president to function. But one of Trump's first actions, I think back in January or February, was to fire prominent members of these boards, the Democratic appointed members of these boards, making them not able to release final decisions. So it's my understanding that it does impact the union's ability to receive final decisions. And then this, it combined with the executive order that ends collective bargaining for about 4 out of 5 federal workers. It's the biggest action of union busting, I think, in U.S. history is what I read. And then that in conjunction with Schedule F, which would create the at-will status for employees, meaning that people could be fired at will, which, in my opinion, introduces partisanship into the civil service. All three of those combined, you know, firing the members of the board, executive orders, and then Schedule F severely hinders the union's ability to operate as it would normally.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of near unprecedented attacks on unorganized labor through some of these executive actions. And it does make me sort of wonder about like the state of labor militancy in the country. And this might be a little bit outside the scope of, you know, the functionings of the EPA. But I'm curious about whether during the scope of your union activism, you've been able to like make connections with members of other unions and start to think about, you know, more cross-union solidarity and, you know, building movement power to start to be able to have a little bit more of a critical mass against this sort of stuff, which is something that we're you know, unfortunately a little bit weak on here in the United States.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people are, maybe for lack of a better word, being radicalized right now. We're understanding just how severe the attacks of this administration are, not just on federal workers, but on a lot of people in this country. So the one thing that gives me hope is kind of the solidarity building that I've seen come out of this. And I've seen it happen definitely on the labor side. So, I mean, that's a big part of unions, right, is solidarity amongst workers. So, you know, we are trying to talk with FEMA, trying to talk with HHS, trying to talk with other federal workers to see how we can spread the message about what's happening inside the government. Because I think that, to get back to your question, that's one of the major benefits of being in a union, right, is you're not part of the management chain of, you know, the executive branching down to you. The union is separate from that. So we're able to kind of speak truth to power, talk about what's actually going on under the protections of the union. I think the unions have been the most effective at messaging what's at risk at losing the EPA, at losing HHS, at losing FEMA. You know, it's people's lives and it's people's health. I think also having the backing of a federal union that has resources like legal resources and have people who can guide you through processes, it helps people feel more empowered to utilize their rights under the Whistleblower Protection Act to raise, you know, illegal actions that are happening. And I think through the union, there are laws that prevent federal employees from doing things like lobbying under the Hatch Act and the Anti-Lobbying Act, but you are able to lobby on behalf of your labor union. So I think being part of a union helps get the message out to Congress, too, about what's happening, because in a lot of cases, even members of Congress don't fully understand how the destruction that's happening in the civil service will impact their constituents.
Yeah, and on that theme of what's being lost, I'm curious, there's a bit of a delicate question that I've wanted to ask, and it feels a little bit difficult to talk about at a time where so many of our public agencies are under threat of, you know, some of the most dire austerity measures that we've seen in our lifetimes. But I worked for a while at an environmental justice organization in Detroit, Michigan, and people had mixed opinions of the EPA when we were there, right? You know, I knew some folks who we had the EPA director at the time under the Biden administration come do a photo op in Detroit, and then nothing changed. And it's my opinion that a lot of that can be chalked up to under-resourcing of these federal agencies, and the fact that their legal scope actually doesn't necessarily go far enough in being able to rein in some of the worst polluters in the country. How do you consider that at a moment when these agencies are really under attack and we are at risk of losing their functions entirely, which would be an incalculable loss? But at the same time, thinking about the people who might have like kind of slipped through the cracks and were victimized by the failure to adequately resource some of these agencies?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. The EPA was not perfect before. The federal government was not perfect before, and that can't be the message because everyone knows that's not true. I believe that what we're seeing right now is a reaction to the fact that the government hasn't worked for the everyday people, the working class, in a long time. I mean, every day we're seeing people die of preventable diseases, die of exposure in our country. The gap between the rich and the poor is higher than it's ever been. We're noticing that people in their 20s and 30s do not have the same conditions as their parents' generation or their parents' parents' generation even, right? There's a lot of frustration, and we can't pretend like the government was perfect before. It wasn't. It was far from it. And I think that that's what we're seeing is people demanding something different. But I don't think we're going to get what we want and what works for working class people by slashing public resources and then adding to the federal deficit to pay for mass deportation and tax cuts for the rich, right? But you're right. We have to be honest with ourselves. The government wasn't perfect before, but it's not going to be more perfect by slashing what was working. I think that Trump's messaging of drastically changing the government, rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse resonated with a lot of people who are frustrated. And I think there are real tangible things that we could to decrease waste, fraud, and abuse, but it's not what's happening now. I think if we really wanted to root out abuse and fraud, we could get rid of corporate campaign donations that lead to regulatory advantages for certain sectors like the coal industry or the chemical industry. We could end, you know, corporate welfare and actually put money back into improving public resources. So, I mean, I totally agree with you. And I think the narrative moving forward can't be that we have to go back to what it was. It has to be to make it better and make it actually work for people. And that's not slashing it.
Yeah, I think that right now we're in this moment of rupture, right? There's so much happening. I mean, you see just today and yesterday, the protests against ICE all across Los Angeles. You know, you mentioned we're spending all these resources on criminalizing people, on deporting people, on, you know, suppressing pro-Palestine activists, while under the guise of eliminating waste, we're eliminating critical functions of the state. And I'm wondering whether you have any just opinions as an individual and as someone who has worked in the government for a long period of time of, you know, what needs to be done to restore people's faith that public services can be good, that they can operate for the public good? Because I think you're right. I think that a lot of people see that message of, you know, we're eliminating waste, and they do see agencies that haven't necessarily made an impact in their life or a visible impact. And they do see failing infrastructure and all this other rot, which, you know, in many ways is itself a product of austerity, and you know, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? But yeah, I'm curious about whether you have any opinions on how to kind of move the public consciousness in that direction. I know that's a big question for one person.
That is a great question. If I knew the answer, maybe I would run for office. I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think the levels of bureaucracy that we have built up makes progress so slow. I think we need to rethink all the red tape. I'm even like hesitating to say that because I don't want to sound like a Republican, but I do think we need to rethink that, because we're not able to respond quickly to people's concerns. It takes years to make tangible action happen. And in some ways that's a good thing, because you want the checks and balances, right? You don't want to see what's happening now, but it wasn't happening effectively before. I think there also needs to be a better way for people to talk to the government, tell the government what's important to them. I mean, I don't know, when you worked for the environmental justice group outside of Detroit, I don't know if you ever dealt with any of the EPA's like public commenting periods or you know, rulemaking decisions, but it's not straightforward how the public can have a say in their own environment or even outside of EPA decisions that impact their life. It's very open.
I was going to say that I think that's true of like more or less every level of government. You know, we did participate in both federal and, you know, state and local level comment periods, and it's all pretty arcane and yes, difficult to manage.
You fax in your letter, right? It's not really keeping up with modern times. So there needs to be more transparency. There needs to be a better way for people to tell the government what's important to them. And there needs to be a better way for the government to respond. I think the old way of doing things isn't working anymore. I also think the government kind of has a PR issue, if I may say. You know, I'm not here to say I'm the biggest Biden fan, but, you know, Biden did do, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, which were two major policies that, you know, if they weren't being terminated, could have really infused marginalized communities with a lot of funding to really meaningfully address environmental issues, and also really meaningfully address our crumbling and aging infrastructure. But I don't think enough people knew exactly the benefits of these laws. I don't think a lot of people could, like a lot of lay people who weren't involved in the government could point to them. And to that end, I think acquiring those funds under BIL and IRA was still a largely bureaucratic and complex process. The idea behind the environmental justice block grants were that they would go, you know, directly to communities. And I think in a lot of cases they did, but it still was federal funding that had all of these mountains of rules and regulations attached to it. And I think that is a barrier for small organizations and everyday people to like acquire government resources and make the changes that they want to see in their communities. So I don't know if I really effectively answered your question.
No, it was an enormous question. But yeah, to that last point, I can speak directly to that, which is that we spent about a year, and I think after I left, they eventually did hire an individual specifically to help people navigate that grant process and help people navigate the EJ block grants and provide technical assistance, because no one was ready. All these smaller environmental justice organizations that kind of made up the constellation, you know, the intention is there, of course. There's a lot of money in that pot to go towards good things, but in terms of just getting access to it, I really don't know. I don't know how consistently that's going to happen effectively.
Yeah, and I don't have an answer to this. This is like, I think, posing more questions, but I think perhaps it could have been rushed the way these things were rolled out, right? People weren't ready for it. But I think that was a reaction to our system, right? It's like, yes, we only have 4 years to get out all of this money, to make all these sweeping changes, to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, to put money in the hands of communities. And then with how slow government works, how do you do that in 4 years? It's just, there's something wrong with the system. We have to rethink the system.
Yeah, well, getting back to that, there was a recent report by the Center for Biological Diversity, and they looked over the EPA's employment roles year over year and found that the EPA has lost over 1,500 workers this year, which is almost 10% of its staff. And based on the big, beautiful budget bill, whatever they're calling it these days, it could be more cuts on the way. And, you know, as you're saying, like, this, things are already pretty broken. And I can't imagine, you know, what losing that volume of staff must do in such a short period of time. Could you put into perspective what that even means for the functioning of EPA?
Yeah. So right off the top, I just want to state that before these cuts happened, at the end of the Biden administration, the unions were still calling what was happening at EPA a staffing crisis. Because at the end of the Biden administration, we had over 15% less staff than we had in 1999. So, and to put that in perspective, the mission of the agency, which is to protect human health and the environment, has only grown since 1999. We're having to protect human health and the environment of a only increasing population size, right? We're also at the same time dealing with aging infrastructure. We're dealing with heightened impacts of climate change, so more severity and more frequency of natural disasters. There's emerging contaminants like PFAS that we're also having to research and respond to. And then also just everyday science and research that we're doing and having to change, for example, change the limits on lead pollution because of emerging research, as well as emerging research on the technologies to clean up lead. So keeping up with how science progresses, we're always having to reevaluate rules and regulations. And then on top of that, there's all these laws and regulations, right? But we know, you've worked in environmental justice, I've worked in environmental justice, we know that laws are not enough to protect everyone. So having to go above and beyond the law to try to ensure that there is now more work towards equitable environmental protection for all people. So that's just to say that environmental protection has only ramped up since 1999, but at the end of the Biden administration, 15% less staff. As you stated, there's reports that say, and we don't know, we can't get numbers from the agency, but there are reports saying that there are 1,500 less workers. I am sure that there are more cuts on the way. They're actively working to dismantle the Office of Research and Development, which has about, I believe, 1,800 staff. The environmental justice staff have not yet been laid off. They also released Elon Musk, like to call it the fork, the deferred resignation program. There's been two rounds of that. It's my understanding that 3,000 people applied for the deferred resignation, again, out of 1,500 to start with, applied for the deferred resignation. We still don't know the final numbers on who has taken that, but we're seeing a gutting of the EPA. And as we mentioned before, the issue, or one of the issues with public services, is that there wasn't enough people. So, I mean, I don't know how, to answer your question, I don't know how EPA will keep up with its mission to protect human health and the environment. I think people will die from these cuts. And I think in order to fulfill just the most basic statutory functions of the EPA, we're not even thinking about going above and beyond and doing voluntary programs at this point, but to fulfill the most basic functions of EPA, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, parts of which they are trying to overturn, I think they're either going to have to privatize it, contract it out, which we know is less efficient, more costly, and can introduce bias into the system, or it's just not going to be done.
Yeah, and what you're speaking about is, I think, the story that we're kind of hearing across the board relative to some of these federal agencies. You know, one thing that we're dealing with here is that the entire staff of LIHEAP, the Low Income Heating Assistance Program, that federal grant program, which, again, it's vastly underfunded to begin with and so much less functional than it could and should be, but regardless is a valuable source of heating assistance for some of the poorest people in the country. the program's not been eliminated, but its entire staff has. So it's just, you know, it's anybody's guess as to whether it's maintaining any sort of basic function right now. I think my assumption is no. I don't see how it could be. And that's kind of what your response made me think of, is that, you know, we're seeing this story play out. And what I keep coming back to is, over and over again, is this is almost just an acceleration of a process that we've seen over the past half century at this point, of the erosion of these public agencies, the erosion of state capacity, and a very conscious conservative political agenda to make these agencies worse, to make the state worse at completing its basic functions, and then say, hey, government doesn't work. We need even less of it. And in that way, I feel that the Trump administration's actions and Elon Musk's weird agency and all of that is almost just a supercharged version of what we've been seeing over the past half century. So, you know, we've seen this kind of go down all over the federal government. Where do you even think about starting to fight back? How can people support the workers at the EPA and help push back against things and think about a different model for moving forward?
You're asking really great questions. I wish I had really great answers. I guess just to go back to what you were saying, you're right. I think what we're seeing is this consolidation of power. We're seeing hypocrisy play out with Trump, you know, valuing cooperative federalism and putting the power back into the states while simultaneously slashing state funding for a lot of things, but on the EPA front, things like infrastructure for clean drinking water and clean wastewater. So we're seeing the encouragement of privatization of government, which does not make things more efficient and does not make things more cost effective. It just puts more money and more power into the hands of a few individuals who are not regulated by, for example, the merit system or the Hatch Act. So I think my answer would be class consciousness. I think we need to take the power out of the hands of the few and redistribute it back to the people. We deserve to demand a government and a system that works for us. And I think what we're seeing is a system that only works for the top 1% of the 1%. As far as fighting back against what we're seeing at the EPA is, I think we need to hold our leaders accountable. I know that there's a lot of frustration with the government and the way Congress has been operating, but I think we need to keep trying. We need to tell our elected officials what's important to us, push back against the dismantling of public protections, push back against the dismantling of public health. And I would also like to encourage more young people to run for office. I think what we've been talking about a lot over the past 40 minutes is the systems don't work. We can't abide by the same things that have been happening. I think the Republicans have done a really good job about getting organized, right? I think that's why we're seeing what we're seeing now, is they were really organized. The Heritage Foundation has been really organized for the past several decades. And that's why we're seeing such a quick dismantling. I think people who don't like what's happening also need to get organized.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a good place as any to leave it. So Ellie Hagen, former EPA worker, and always environmental advocate, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Ellie Hagen, former scientist in the Environmental Justice Program at the EPA. I want to thank Ellie once again for providing such valuable insight into her experience at the EPA and her knowledge of federal agency work. Ultimately, speaking with Ellie drove home for me that there's really no sugarcoating how bad things are right now and how much work it'll take to build or rebuild government institutions that actually have the requisite power and democratic legitimacy to tamp down the influence of large polluters on our lives and to assist in the cause of environmental justice rather than slowing it down. Obviously, neither of us had any definite big answers for this stuff, and if we did, I think we'd be out doing that rather than brainstorming on a radio show. But the necessity of strong people's movements, of an organized labor movement with the strength and the political will to fight for the common good, these are things that we've been coming back to again and again on this show, and they're things that we don't have enough of right now. And getting enough of them is much easier said than done, but I think Ellie was correct to point to them as potential vehicles for regaining and hopefully surpassing our ability to protect our environment and ourselves. And there may just not be a substitute for the slow and hard work of making that happen. With that, that is today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, we've got some tunes for a little bit, and then at the top of the hour is On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be Sunday, July 6th. Until then, take care.
Thank you, Diaz. Thank you.
Like, we prepared for it, yeah.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Imagine you're a bowhead whale. You're bigger than a school bus and spend your time swimming in the Arctic. Perhaps you're more than a century old.
And so that means you remember a time when the only noise in the ocean in your habitat was coming from wind and sea ice and waves and the various clicks and whistles and songs that other wildlife make.
But Sam Davin of the World Wildlife Fund Canada says today the Arctic is no longer so quiet. It's filled with the drone of ship propellers and the blasts of air guns used in oil and gas exploration. For a whale, the noise is not just a matter of disturbing the peace.
It's harder for you to navigate. It's harder for you to communicate. It's harder for you to avoid danger.
Studies have shown that underwater noises can cause bowhead whales to swim closer to shore, reduce their calls, and alter their dive cycles. And the Arctic is getting even noisier. As the climate warms, Arctic sea ice is melting, which enables more ship traffic in the region. So Davin's organization advocates for governments to monitor and regulate underwater noise to help protect bowheads and other vulnerable animals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
And again, we thank all of our listeners, donors, contributors, community partners that helped keep WEFT viable and on the air.
Research shows that mentors play a powerful role in providing young people with the tools to strive and thrive, to attend and engage in school, and to reduce risky behavior. Make a difference in your community by becoming a CU One-to-One mentor. Visit www.cuoneto1.org or call the Champaign or Urbana School District for more information.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. On a hot afternoon in Russell Field, a park in Cambridge, Massachusetts, families often eat around a long picnic table under a canopy of mesh fabric that billows in the wind. It's an art installation and gathering space designed for the Shade is Social Justice project.
We were looking at the ways we could bring temporary shade during the summer and also bring in imagination and creativity to spark interest.
Claudia Zarazua runs the city-led program. As the climate warms, heat waves are growing more intense, and it can be hard to find places to cool off, especially in areas with few shade trees. So this initiative provided funding for artists and designers to create shade structures at five locations. Architect Alejandro Saldarriaga Rubio helped design the installation at Russell Field, which does more than provide temporary shade. The wooden poles holding up the mesh fabric double as tree stakes, supporting young saplings that were planted last year. So for now, the mesh fabric provides shade.
Until the trees are fully grown and those specific trees will be the ones to provide the shade.
So over time, the installation will become a permanent shaded space where the community can keep cool as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Ann and I always like to let you know that if your organization has an upcoming fundraiser or wish to provide a service to the community, and be it a music or art event, workshop, or educational seminar, simply send a short script to WEFT at psa@weft.org. And we'll be sure to include it in our on-air public service announcements. You can also drop a flyer off here at the station or mail it to WEFT, 113 North Market Street, Champaign, Illinois, 61820.
Good news, good planet. It's time now for your good news for a good planet. A doll like me. Children with disabilities or differences rarely see themselves represented in toys. Amy Jandrasevitz is changing that with her extraordinary charity, A Doll Like Me. The former social worker turned doll maker creates custom dolls that resemble their owners, covering a range of conditions from limb differences to cancer and birthmarks. Each doll is painstakingly handcrafted to match the child's physical appearance and distinctive features. People from around the world inundate her with requests for these incredible custom dolls for their children. Amy begins with photos of the child and details about their differences. She spends about 7 hours on each doll, and as of early 2024, had made over 300 of them. Despite the demand, Amy insists on creating each doll herself by hand. And next to the wonderful reaction from the kids, the best part is that the dolls come at no cost to the families. Each one is funded by direct public donations and a GoFundMe campaign. A Doll Like Me is about changing the narrative of representation in children's toys. It shows kids with disabilities and differences that they belong. AdollLikeMe.com is where anyone can donate and participate in a small step towards a world where special children feel included, one unique doll at a time. And this is Mandy with GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com. Good news.
If you have a passion for bluegrass, local music, or reggae, then you are in luck because you are tuned to 90.1 FM WEFT. Our programming is created by our volunteer staff. At WEFT, it is elected committee members, enthusiastic airshifters, and dedicated members who decide what is unique and important to hear on the radio. WEFT is home to a wealth of knowledgeable hosts who bring you fascinating programs each week. Whether you're into gospel or jazz, Celtic jigs or Delta blues, salsa or hip-hop, we've got a show for you. If you have a passion for unique music and information, show it and help us continue to provide this service to you. Please go to weft.org and click on the Support WEFT link.
I'm Julie Pride, the administrator of Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. I support WEFT Community Radio because it offers community-specific content that engages listeners more than regular media. During the COVID-19 pandemic, WEFT programming allowed me and CU Public Health District to reach out with targeted information and to answer the questions of listeners. Support independent, accessible, volunteer-operated, and community-supported radio in East Central Illinois. Visit weft.org and make your contribution.